Monster High Girl Dress Up Party New College Girl Zed Scary Fashion on Campus Life Free. This is Up Up Down Down, the show about the craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment. Later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Federico Vitici. Federico is editor-in-chief of Mac Stories, co-host of Relay FM's video game show, Virtual. Hi, Federico. How's it going?
Hey, guys. I'm doing good. Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here on the podcast.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. Our topic today is digital distribution of games. So obviously, the world has changed dramatically over the last 5 or 10 years with the introduction of Steam, and now every major platform vendor has their own way of distributing games digitally. And in particular, we were sort of curious and interested in how that's affected the independent games, how that's affected what games are getting made, what games are profitable, what games are plausible. And because we have Federico here and he is quite knowledgeable about the Nintendo world more so than me, I wanted to kick off by getting an update from him on what has Nintendo been doing in this realm. Because I'm familiar with the Steam side and the PlayStation, the PSN side, and obviously the App Store, which I'm sure we'll get to. But I've been hearing sort of second and third hand that Nintendo has been kind of in last place at trying to adopt this sort of trend of having indie downloadable games. But it's starting to get there. Is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a timely discussion because just yesterday I saw an interview on Gamasutra with the guys that are in charge of Nintendo's new indie division. And it looks like Nintendo is kind of catching up. But to offer a bit of a background, Nintendo's been really late to the not just to the indie game but also to the digital distribution trend, I guess. They were late with eShop, they were late with online gaming, and in general, I guess Nintendo's online infrastructure was not just underpowered when compared to what Sony and Microsoft and of course Steam were doing. But they were late with the distribution of digital software because Nintendo was insisting on selling physical copies of games. So going back to the, for instance, to a few years ago, Nintendo launched the DSiWare mini games, I would say, software on the for the original Nintendo DS, and later they followed up with the eShop. And the problem isn't just that Nintendo has been late compared to Sony and Microsoft, is that Nintendo has been traditionally a closed ecosystem for developers. It was difficult for developers to become a Nintendo developer, a registered Nintendo developer, back when games were sold physically. And it was even harder to become a registered Nintendo developer for the eShop, for digital downloads, because Nintendo had really strict policies for the kind of people that they were accepting to sell software on the eShop. Now, in the past few years, thanks to the contribution of new people at Nintendo who understood the potential for indie games, for embracing more and more developers on the eShop, they've been trying to get more original software and new software for the Nintendo 3DS and the Wii U. So yesterday I was reading this interview with two folks from Nintendo's indie development program, and they are really honest about the fact that Nintendo has been late compared to Sony and Microsoft and of course Steam. And especially after the iPhone and the iPad and the Apple App Store, Nintendo really needed to figure out a way to approach this indie phenomenon. And so I read a couple of interesting things about the way that Nintendo changed when it comes to indie developers. For instance, they now have a sort of a loan program for getting development units. So basically, you can get a development kit for free for a year, and then you can pay back Nintendo after you released your game, and hopefully you made some money. So that's a kind of a big change for developers, and also Nintendo has been doing many workshops. They've been reaching out to the indie community. They've been going to events such as Indiecade. Or the Game Developers Conference, they always have people there trying to approach indie developers and trying to teach them how to make software for the 3DS and for the what Nintendo calls the Nintendo Web Framework, which is a collection of HTML5 and Java tools to make games.
That sounds like a lot of fun, I'm sure.
Yeah, making I know, right?
A game on Nintendo platform is probably a little more annoying than Sony and Microsoft anyway, but then you add Java and HTML.
See, that's the big problem for Nintendo, because in the digital age, in spite of the changes that they've been making to the eShop, so trying to reaching out to the community, doing curation for the eShop homepage, they've been active on Twitter and other social media to try to get the word out about all these games that people can download digitally. They have a basic problem of development tools and technologies, and the infrastructure itself of the eShop and buying games as a consumer is problematic compared to Sony and Microsoft. For instance, to make a comparison, Sony is offering tools like Unity and Monogame and Game Maker Studio, which are, I guess, the three most popular game-making tools, essentially for free, for PlayStation 3, PlayStation 4, and PS Vita developers. They have this program called the PlayStation Mobile program that lets developers port their games to the PS Vita for free, and in general, and I guess this is also true for Microsoft, Sony and Microsoft understand that in the digital age, it is essential to make it as simple as possible for developers to program and to release a game and to make it multi-platform and to allow them to save time developing and you know, trying to understand all the problems of a console and just make the game and release the game and market the game to as many people as possible. And Nintendo has this basic problem that they don't have the same tools, they don't have the same access, so they're trying to get better, but they're still behind. And Nintendo has been saying a bunch of times, for the next console, we want to have a more unified platform. We want to allow people to more easily create games that can run on a portable console, on the home console, that can have some sort of integration, so exchange functionalities and save data. And they always say that they're considering, you know, this kind of future. And in the meantime, Sony and Microsoft, they are actually doing this stuff. So hopefully for the next major console, Nintendo will fix all these problems. I guess right now it's good news that they're trying, at least from the community perspective, that they're trying to reach out to developers, and they're making, you know, they have a big presence on YouTube and Twitter. But the big problem, I think, is the technologies and the actual development part, which is behind.
I think another big mistake that Nintendo made with their digital strategy over the last little while was having all the stuff tied to the consoles.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That's something that Nintendo did. I think they've moved away from it now with the Wii U. I'm not sure what the situation is on the 3DS, but certainly with the DS and with the original Wii, when you bought a game for your physical console, essentially.
Yeah.
So you know, you bought it, you downloaded it, it was on that console could play it, and if that console got run over by a truck, the game was gone with it. There was no concept of having a network ID and tying stuff to it, and you can log in from a different machine later and restore all your stuff. And like, as a consumer, that was a huge reason for me to not get, even, you know, there's stuff I would have bought, probably more stuff on like Virtual Console on the Wii if I could have had some confidence that my Wii breaking wasn't gonna you know, wasn't going to kind of throw all that money away, you know?
Well, especially as a parent, like how many 3DSs or DSs of various vintages have your kids sort of made their way through from being new to being inoperable? Like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've got stuff that they purchased on like their old DSs that they just can't, you know, they can't play anymore because those DSs, we still physically have them, but they're, you know, they've died in various ways. And it's like, oh, yeah, probably we can send them off to Nintendo and there's, you know, there's something to be done, but it's, you know, it's a pain. And that makes me really nervous about committing too much to the Nintendo ecosystem of digital download. The fact that they've done things that way, like I said, I think they've moved away from it more now, but that I believe that was holding them back in the area that digital download kind of started coming of age on the Xbox and Xbox 360 and PS3, right? That digital download, you know, for like AAA games wasn't really a thing yet on those consoles, but certainly for indie titles, for DLC, stuff like that, you know, there was lots of that on those consoles and just not, no one, you know, no one as a consumer would really commit to it on the Nintendo consoles, I think, because of the potential of losing it all.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's still the case with the 3DS and to an extent the Wii U. Just a few months ago, my friend Mike, basically Mike buys all of his games on the eShop because he wants to keep as many games on his console as possible. And at some point, his SD card, for some reason, it kind of exploded, like it lost all of his data. And because Nintendo doesn't have a backup feature, like on your account, and you need to do this kind of weird magic trick with transferring purchases from one device to another, basically Mike lost all of his games and progress, and so basically everything, and Nintendo makes it really hard to re-download stuff that you bought previously, and if you want to back up your data, you need to connect to a PC, and compare that to, for instance, to the PSN, right? I have a PS Vita and I buy a lot of indie stuff on the PSN. You can start download, you can buy games on your computer and then you can download them on the console. You can re-download stuff easily. You can backup stuff easily. And on the 3DS, as you say, as a consumer, it kind of makes me I don't want to commit too much to the digital games on the eShop. And I guess as a reflection of this behavior, developers may see fewer downloads on the eShop than on other platforms because of all this friction that there is to Nintendo's ecosystem and devices.
On the 3DS in particular, because it's targeted at kids and it's got these tiny, irritating little carts that are trivial to lose. Like, I would love to be able to just say, like, all right, from now on, all of the kids' games for the 3DS are getting purchased digitally. But it's, yeah, it's just not practical in the current environment. There's just too much risk in losing that stuff.
So you guys would know the answer to this. Back in the day when I was checking out the virtual console for the Wii, which I still have, I'm not at the U yet, if I ever am, we'll see. But on the Wii virtual console, there was this like section for, I don't know if it was indie games, but for like small games, I guess they're semi-indie. But you had to like go off into this like weird corner to find it that like virtually no one would ever do unless they'd been given explicit instructions. Is the sort of indie section still separate of their shop?
Yeah, it's kind of better now. So they have all these, if you go to the eShop, they have all these collections, I guess. It's basically like the App Store. Each week there's, I guess there's an editorial team at Nintendo and they have this great indie games collection on the homepage. And you get a list of indie games, but it's not a complete list. It's just, you know, the editorial picks from Nintendo. I guess that it is better than what it used to be. I remember back in the Wii and DS days, it was really hard to discover the WiiWare and DSiWare games. Right now it's easier also because, you know, there's a lot more I guess, indie coverage on gaming blogs, also because Nintendo uses YouTube and Twitter to promote these games. But if you go to the actual eShop, they've been doing some sort of better browsing options. They have these collections, they do promotions on a regular basis. So it's easier. It's not ideal, but it's easier. Yeah.
It sounds like it's improving. When I looked, there's a section with the sign that said, beware of the leopard in the corner. Like, basically, just don't go here. We sort of wanted, we had some political thing where we said internally we were going to allow indie games, but we didn't want anyone to accidentally come across some game that wasn't up to Nintendo's standards.
And that's, I mean, that's always kind of been Nintendo's problem. Like, I don't think it's just a matter of that the, you know, that they make it hard to find indie games or anything like that. It's just that fundamentally, a lot of third-party publishers just don't have a lot of faith in Nintendo. You know, it's not like they have an easier time getting like AAA third-party games on their platforms. The combination of like them being kind of insular and them really focusing on their effort on their own games, and you know, because they're making more money off of them, and all of that stuff makes, you know, that stuff bleeds over into the digital download realm as well, that Nintendo's primarily making a platform to get their games out there. And if other people happen to have success on them, like, they're totally happy to allow that, but they're not going to go out of their way to do it. Whereas Sony and Microsoft both publish games for their own consoles, but they're not committed to it the way that Nintendo is, right? Like, if, you know, if some like antitrust legislation came down and said like, all right, no video game console manufacturers are allowed to publish games for their own systems, like, Sony and Microsoft would just shrug and cancel their first party development and keep going, whereas Nintendo would be out of business. Like, you know, that's the difference in commitment between the first party and third-party ecosystems on the various consoles.
There has been, Federico actually linked this up before we started, the example of Shovel Knight, which is a game I haven't had a chance to play yet. I don't know if there's a Mac version, or at least there wasn't when it originally came out.
Yeah, it's on Steam, yeah.
Yeah, oh, it's on Steam now. At the time, I believe it was Windows, yeah. Wii U, and 3DS when it originally came out, which is an interesting sort of platform split. And they were sort of anticipating like, well, you know, I don't know. They seemed to have a little bit of hesitance around choosing Nintendo's platforms as their, I'm sure there was some deal that wasn't mentioned in this article, which I'll link in between then and Nintendo at some point. But they found that 64% of their sort of Kickstarter backers said that they were on PC. So they're like, how many copies are we going to actually sell on the window or on the Nintendo platforms? But when they launched in the first month, they ended up making like a couple million dollars off of this indie game, and there was fairly evenly split in between Wii U, 3DS, and Windows Steam sales. So there is definitely, you know, more viability there, at least for sort of indie developers. You know, making a couple million dollars is not gonna make back the money you spent building Assassin's Creed, but on a sort of like NES style sort of 2D game, it definitely could.
Yeah, and it is an exception, I guess, right? I mean, Shovel Knight got a lot of press, a lot of marketing, and they had this crazy successful Kickstarter campaign. I don't think that any indie developer is like Yacht Club Games that made Shovel Knight, but they are a nice success story on the eShop, and it's a fantastic game, by the way. Actually, I'm playing the game this week. It is amazing on the 3DS, and that's the thing, right? I mean, it's there's so much potential for nice indie games on Nintendo consoles, and especially in the 3DS, because it's portable, because it's got this I would say decent hardware, especially the new 3DS, which I really want to get next year. And it's the kind of machine that I really want to carry around and put a lot of games on it. And Nintendo still struggles to approach developers, to convince third-party developers, whether big or small, to use Nintendo platforms. And the result is that I mostly have Nintendo games on my Nintendo consoles and indie games on my PS Vita. Which I guess is also a reflection of the way those two companies see their consoles. Nintendo, as Nigel said, making Nintendo games, and Sony actually dropped first-party development for the PS Vita, and they announced that they're going to focus on indie games and remote play. So yeah, I guess I'm using my 3DS and my Vita as the hardware manufacturers want me to use it. And it's a shame because the 3DS could have a lot of potential for indie games.
Yeah, I think that's also sometimes a challenge of what the developers are using as their consoles. You know, often if an indie game developer is focused on a particular platform, whether it's Windows or iOS or whatever it is that they use, then that's going to be what they sort of start prototyping on. That's what they're going to be excited about. And so if any particular indie developer is not a user of the 3DS and they're not a fan of the 3DS necessarily, then unless it's, you know, easy for them to port over to it, or Nintendo is incentivizing that, they're not necessarily going to do it. Which is why I find it's interesting, this thing of them using or working towards getting Unity, which is the super popular sort of cross-platform development environment, working on 3DS, because there's a lot of people who are like, even I have been over the last week sort of prototyping a game with Nigel and kind of going back and forth and thinking about, it's just on iOS and it would only work on iOS right now. But I'm like, well, if we were going to actually end up making this into a game, then maybe I'd want to rewrite this in Unity, because then it's just kind of like, you know, it's going to work on everything, and that would bring it to the Mac and then sort of everything. So then, you know, man, maybe it becomes a smash sensation and then port it to the 3DS because it's already written in Unity, right?
Yeah, and I'm glad that you mentioned developing on iOS, because another point that I wanted to make is there are so many games, right, on the iPhone and iPad app store, but all those games, the developers of those games can use their primary devices to develop those games, to test those games. Whereas for all these other consoles, you have to apply for a development kit, you have to pay for it, and you have to wait. There are slower times, and you need to be a registered developer. Whereas for the App Store, all you need to do is pay $100, and you become a registered iOS developer, and you use your iPhone, you download Xcode, and you start making a game. So there's an argument to be made about, you know, the App Store makes it easier to create games, and there are hundreds of fantastic games that are exclusive to the iPhone and to the iPad. But on the other hand, all these games on the App Store, it's really hard to discover, you know, a quality indie game that doesn't try to scam you with in-app purchases, that doesn't try to, you know, to do all those weird little tricks that sometimes big companies do with iPhone games. And so you have easier access, easier development tools, but you also have, I guess for Apple, a curation problem. You need to recommend games to people. There's too many games, probably. And Nintendo and Sony and Microsoft have a little more traditional, I guess, and slower approach, but they can actually recommend a lot of quality games on a weekly basis, and people don't go crazy trying to understand, oh my God, what kind of game can I play this week? You know?
Well, there's actually a really interesting distinction in between the platforms of the App Store and Steam versus the consoles, where if you allow pretty much anyone to put any game within reason on your platform, and so that's kind of what Apple and Steam are doing, although some people would say, like, oh, it's a walled garden and you can't put anything on Steam, but like, there's a lot of games on Steam, there's a lot of apps on App Store, so, you know, in contrast to consoles, there's, you know, it's very open. But even if something is not easily discoverable on the front page, it's not so promoted by Valve or by Apple, you can link to it with a URL. And so you can say, oh, here's a, you know, review, click here and you can buy the game. Or you can message your friend, hey, click here and just buy it if you're on that sort of device. Whereas basically no one is browsing the internet on their PlayStation 4. Even if you could, maybe it's possible somehow, it would be highly unpleasant. And so there's that extra sort of barrier to, if you allow your store to just be populated with a huge amount of noise, it's going to be even harder for anyone to find the noise, and that's also going to make it somewhat harder for people to find the highest quality stuff. So there is, like, although I totally agree that the general idea of allowing more content in and then using algorithmic curation and sort of person-to-person curation and search and referrals to, you know, make sales is a good thing, and that the consoles should be moving that way, there is that one sort of distinction which I think makes it a little bit harder for the consoles.
And I think the thing that Sony and Microsoft particularly are doing with that, of kind of inching down market on that stuff, you know, that they started out from the traditional console place of like, everything's on a disc and you have to, you know, you have to have an investment of tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars to even get in the door on development. And then like, all right, well, you know, we'll give dev kits to a few well-known indie developers and like strongly, put a digital download thing in place and strongly encourage them to come on the platform and gradually sort of widening it out. And I do think that the requirement for custom hardware is a, you know, currently an almost unmovable bar in that ultimately, you know, you need special development hardware, and that's going to be some cost that's going to be out of the reach of a certain level of indie. You know, there's not going to be any benefit to someone going and making like a tic-tac-toe game and putting ads on it the way that you can, you know, not make enough money to even justify development of the game, but make like a trickle of money from that on the iOS app store. You just can't afford to do something like that on the consoles, because you have to buy this like couple $1,000 piece of development hardware to be able to run stuff, you know, like Federico mentioned before. But yeah, I mean, you can certainly see that over the console generations, you know, Sony and Microsoft have been opening up more and more. And Nintendo's been doing the same thing. They're just like a generation behind. You know, Nintendo now is trying to reach for the point that Sony and Microsoft were last round of, you know, a few like curated quality small games. And now Sony and Microsoft are opening it up even more and really encouraging a broader cross-section of the indie gaming world, not going all the way down to the like free 99-cent kind of games that you've got in the App Store. Whereas Apple started very much from the other end, right? As they just said, open it up to anything and see what happens. And unfortunately, what has happened is that lots of free and 99 cents things kind of dominate the listings, because people seem to want that kind of toss it away once you're done with it entertainment on phones. And so the quality gaming experiences are certainly there, but it's a lot tougher for them to get traction because of that discoverability issue, that there's just too much of the other stuff. But I definitely feel a lot more confident. Like, if I say, hey, I want to play a good game that's going to have some depth, I would never do that by going and just browsing around the App Store. Whereas I feel like, you know, you could just fire up the PlayStation Store front end and like go to the indie games section and like scroll through it and be reasonably confident that the games that you get there, you're going to get a reasonable experience out of.
So something I totally did not realize until I was just saying, oh, well, you can't just link to a game on PSN that someone said, oh, you should buy this. But then I realized, like, maybe they have that now. And I went on to the PlayStation website and logged in and searched for Transistor, which is a game I've been wanting to play as an indie game, and then clicked buy and then clicked download to my PS4, and it's now downloading to my PS4. Yeah. So actually, it totally works fine, and they don't have any excuse anymore, so I take that back.
Yeah, it's still not the kind of direct integration that you get on an iPhone. Like, you see a link on your iPhone, you open the App Store, and you have an app or a game. But also, Sony has been making progress with the online PSN. They have kind of the same problem of Apple and Nintendo and basically any other, I guess, online store, that there's like a delay between being able to find the game through search and downloading the game. Sometimes if you know the direct link to a game, you can buy the game before it shows up in search. So it's really kind of like the App Store. I guess it's a... all these companies, they share the same CDN provider, probably. I don't know. But yeah, Sony has been making progress. I don't know about Xbox, honestly.
Xbox and PS4 are, like, the Xbox One and the PS4 are pretty much on the same tier as far as what they offer. And that was more or less true last round as well, that there's, you know, there's a well-developed ecosystem there. There's a fair number of indie games. I think Sony's maybe a little more indie game friendly, but not dramatically so, not to the degree of the difference between like Microsoft and Nintendo in terms of indie friendliness. And, you know, both of them have got good storefronts that make an effort to kind of create some virtual, you know, virtual facing out kind of space to highlight games and stuff like that, that, you know, they have both pretty good storefronts.
Yeah. What, and you mentioned that, Sony, appears to be a little more, indie developer friendly. And something that came in mind is, not only the kind of efforts that Sony goes through, we interviewed on our previous podcast, Directional, with Mike Shahid Ahmad. He's the guy at PlayStation Europe in charge of basically discovering all these crazy indie games and promoting all these teams, such as Hotline Miami, what's the other? No Man's Sky, which is coming to PS4. So the guy is basically amazing. He talks to a lot of developers every day, but also Sony in general, not just PlayStation Europe. In December, next month, they have this 2-day community event called the PlayStation Experience. I don't know if you guys saw the news. It's basically this 2-day event in Vegas, I think. And they have over 20 panels with discussions with, AAA game developers, indie developers, voice actors for video games on PlayStation consoles. And Sony is really trying hard to highlight this community aspect, both when it comes to players and when it comes to the people who make video games. And this kind of initiative, I guess it's maybe Microsoft is doing something along those lines, but certainly not Nintendo or Apple, which, you know, Apple, the only developer event they do is the WWDC, which is very much focused on the technicalities of developing for Apple platforms, not on the community, right?
And I think that community aspect of things is really important. I mean, it's something we've talked about before with some of the indie game developers we've had on, but at the indie level, you know, you don't have that ability to like put a game on limited shelf space in the stores that people are browsing, and you can't buy like TV spots to notify people about things. Like, people have to hear about your game and go looking for it, as opposed to it being put in front of them and them deciding whether or not they want to buy it. And so, you know, absolutely, that whole community aspect of it is a huge part of what makes indie games work. So I think that, I mean, that's smart on Sony's part to do that, to like have sort of a sense of like, yeah, developers and gamers are on the same team as far as making these indie games successful, because they're, you know, they can't operate in the same way that the AAA games do as far as how they get publicized.
The indie game scene community thing, actually, I hadn't fully understood the degree, how important it was compared to AAA games until I started doing this show and talking to people who were, like, you know, people like Adam Atomic, who was on the show, who pretty much at any given time are working on collaborations with three other indie developers and indie creators that they met just through playing their games or going to events or things like PAX and stuff like that, or just someone you admire their work and so you tweet them and things like that. And that, like, fabric is not as well supported in that world by any of the sort of official platform vendors, at least not by Apple. Other than, like, those indie developers are not necessarily, the game developers are not going to go to WWDC necessarily, especially when it's like $2,000.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could be a little cynical and say, of course, Sony and Microsoft, they are trying to approach indie developers, because in the first year of all these new next generation consoles, they have no good quality first party games or AAA games in general, and they want indie developers to basically fill in all these months of essentially empty big releases with all these smaller but still great indie games. But I guess that, especially Sony, and from you know, the people that I talk to and the developers that I know, they seem to be generally passionate about trying to get indie developers to create games for PlayStation, and it's funny to me, especially when it comes to the PS Vita, to see the evolution of this device. I bought the PS Vita when it came out because you know the promise of a portable console with the same power of a PS3, and I bought the original Uncharted game for the PS Vita, and I was blown away by the graphics. And then the Vita, after a few months of basically no games, it kind of transformed on its own in this approachable and accessible portable console to play indie games that probably came out on Steam, on PC a few months before, and now you can play them on a portable console. And I guess that Sony noticed this trend of developers trying to, let's put some indie games on the PS Vita, and Sony took notice of this trend, and they made it easier with development tools, with all these events, reaching out to the community, establishing internal teams that, you know, reach out to developers and trying to get them on board, both, you know, financially and with advice. And I guess that Microsoft is on the same boat for the Xbox, because when a new console comes out and you don't have many games for that console, it is a good help to have all these other kinds of games. I mean, the PlayStation 4, when it launched, there was a Resogun at launch, and it was an indie game that was, I guess it was pretty much a success for the developer. And it is interesting to consider how the PS Vita especially kind of changed over time.
It's an interesting sort of dilemma for a new game system. Like, there's something not directly related to sort of the issue of digital downloads, but you know, that's kind of been Sony's play for it this round. Is there, like, what's the extra thing that you can do with this console until all the big games have started coming out? And, you know, I think the most famous example of that working out well for someone was with Sony, with both the PS2 and the PS3 got a lot of play, just as like DVD players and Blu-ray players, right? There's a lot of people who bought their PS3s at launch and spent more time watching Blu-rays on them initially. And I think indie games were kind of Sony's bet for that this time around. And Microsoft's bet, it looks like, was the TV stuff in the Xbox One. And I think definitely Sony made the better bet that, you know, the indie ecosystem and the digital download ecosystem, it is, you know, is something that's really growing right now, because there's been so much stuff that's been enabled by the move to digital distribution. Like, so many of these indie games just couldn't have been made in a packaged game environment because the distribution chain costs too much, right? If you're making a game that you're going to retail for $60 and people will play it, then if the people that are like shipping stuff to the retailers and the retailers themselves and all that are taking like $20 off the top of that, you can afford it. Whereas if you want to make a game for $5 or $10, you can't. You know, you can't afford to buy into that distribution chain, and digital distribution just sort of swipes that all away and says, like, yeah, now the distribution costs are basically zero. So, you know, you just sell your game at whatever like commission markup the platform owner is going to take, and the $20 that it costs to put it in a game store in a box is just gone from the equation. And, you know, that's driven the growth of indie games over the last little while. And, you know, Sony clearly noticed that trend and noticed how successful Steam was and noticed how much indie games were on the rise, better than Microsoft did. Or maybe Microsoft just sort of looked at the success they'd had on that stuff with the 360 and said, like, yeah, it did okay, but it's not a it's not a system seller kind of thing, and decided to try the TV stuff, and then, you know, made that decision right in the middle of this huge growth in that style of gaming that's been going on over like the last 4 or 5 years.
I think there's also a fear, reasonable fear, on the part of the console vendors that if they are not providing an experience that you can't get anywhere else, then consoles will start to slide into non-existence, which is something we were kind of concerned about as an industry when the PS4 and the Xbox One are being announced. We're like, well, I like console games, but are there enough other people out there that like console games that they're going to actually buy these things? And the answer has been yes. But thankfully, for those of us who like sort of those big sit on your couch sort of experiences, but there's definitely a question where they're like, okay, well, how many ways are we different than Steam and the PC? And there's definitely the big one is this is a particular hardware profile that is exactly the same. Anyone who has a PS4, you can count on them having exactly these things and you can rely on those things. But that the one of the other big things that they, since the NES era, that the console makers have started differentiating themselves on is this curation aspect of, you know, if a game is being sold on my console, then that the fact that it's available on my console makes you think that it might be good or that it has a certain minimum bar that it's not going to randomly crash or it's not going to have these certain quality problems. And so that sort of laxing of the requirements so that they're allowing more and more indie games. Like I'm sure they had in the sort of PS2 and, you know, PS3 era, even they had like really awesome, amazing indie games that everyone enjoyed that just violated 40 or 100 of the TRC rules that they use to approve whether or not a game can be on the platform. Oh, well, it doesn't have at least 87 achievements. Oh, well, you know, it doesn't have a screen that says press X to start. Oh, it doesn't at least, you know, save its game files in this double redundant whatever way, just in case they're using a, you know, peripheral that we released 4 years ago that no one actually has, but it requires this thing. And there's all those sort of restrictions that they have that it's just kind of like, yeah, in order to bring your, you know, Super Meat Boy, which was like built in Flash to run up on the sort of all those requirements, it would have cost you more than it would have cost to build the game in the first place. So you can see those sort of two tensions, and I'm sure they have like a different set of TRCs now for the this is going on the stores at, you know, Best Buy for $70 versus this is going to be $19.95 in the sort of digital download store. But I definitely think that that is sort of one of the explanations for the slow motion. And then, you know, then you can sort of follow that argument through as to why is Nintendo moving even slower than Sony and Microsoft. And it's, well, if you look at the history of Nintendo as the people who were able to bring the game industry out of its ashes in like 1984 with a console that had way stricter approval rules than Atari had, you know, Atari making so many horrible games that they had to have entire landfills filled with them, and Nintendo just saying, okay, here's the games that hit our bar of quality, and you cannot make a Nintendo game unless you sign our onerous agreements and stuff. And
that's actually a great point, because it made me think of the Nintendo seal of quality.
Exactly.
And it's interesting because now on the App Store, which has the opposite problem, right? Too many games, too many apps, so much software. Apple is doing these little badges like Editor's Choice or there's another one, like App of the Week. They have all these little badges on specific games and apps that kind of say this game is better because we chose it, because we featured it. And so Nintendo may be a little too close, but also it seems to me that the idea of saying, hey, this particular game needs your attention is coming back to the App Store with all these kind of special badges and indicators that because of all the volume that there's on the App Store, people need the recommendations. It turns out, you know, that people like to be told what's good or bad when it comes to software. And Nintendo and Apple are kind of on the two opposite ends of a spectrum, and I believe that there's a good middle ground. It seems to me that maybe nobody kind of is the perfect mix of, you know, let's allow anybody to make software, but also let's do curation right, let's pick, you know, quality stuff. Maybe there's no perfect mix, maybe there's no perfect combination, and maybe we'll keep seeing experiments such as the new Steam curation stuff that lets anyone be a curator on Steam. I don't know. It's interesting because all this digital distribution trend, and now it's an established category of any console or smart device. With all this software, there are many different, you know, aspects to consider. Do you want people to always play quality stuff, or do you want to give people the idea, hey, we have a lot of stuff. It doesn't matter whether it's quality or not. We have a lot of stuff you can choose from. And I don't know if there's a perfect combination of quality and quantity. I guess it's a good problem to have, because we have so many quality stuff these days. It may even seem silly to complain about, hey, we have too much stuff, too many games. But still, it is important to give relevancy to developers who make higher quality games.
I think an interesting thing to think about is that digital distribution, I think, is still a trend in that we don't know what the end game on the consoles is going to look like, right? Like, we can say on smartphones, like, yeah, digital distribution is like all there is on smartphones. And so we know what that market kind of looks like. And, we know the problems and we can see people fighting against the problems, but that, that market's kind of gelled. On the big iron consoles, on the PS4, on the Xbox One, like, things haven't gelled yet. GameStop is still in business. People are still buying actual discs and putting them in their consoles. And we know, I think, more or less for certain that that's going to stop at some point, that eventually you won't be able to purchase games on physical discs anymore. And I think there's a big open question of, like, what is that transition going to look like? What feature sets is digital distribution going to have to pick up in order to finally kill, physical discs? And how are the physical discs distributors going to try and fight to maintain relevance? And, how are you going to buy the console hardware if GameStop goes out of business because you can't sell games digitally anymore? Then, you only go to like big box electronics retailers or Walmart or whatever to buy your consoles. Like, there's, that whole thing's still very much in flux. And I don't think it's clear to anyone in the industry, like, how that's going to settle down. And I think that's a lot of what's behind the various like nervous feints in various directions and trying different things. And like Microsoft having their fairly revolutionary plan for how digital downloads were going to work on the Xbox One, and then completely backing off of it because of the backlash. And like, you can see the ground is still very unsteady under the console industry because of everyone knows there's still big changes to come and they don't know what they are.
It's interesting that you mentioned those little editor's choice. Now, this is like three things back now, but I've been kind of clicking around in the App Store. Those little editor's choice labels and stuff that they put on games, Federico. Have you ever seen those other than in search results or on like the detail pages? Because if you actually just go to the top grossing list, you can't actually see which of those. I mean, probably not many of them are editor's choice because they're often just like click fests and stuff like that. But like Candy Crush Saga, Apple has given it the designation of essentials, which is reasonable. It's a very popular game. But you can't actually see that besides like, dozens and other of these top grossing apps, many of which are like lame casino apps and stuff like that, like free slots, video poker, blackjack, and more, and like stuff like that.
I guess you cannot see those badges in the top charts. You can see them in search, and I guess in product pages at the top. It seems dumb to exclude them from the charts because that's how I guess the majority of people discover new apps. It's definitely something that Apple tweaks a lot over time. They make all these changes to the App Store layout. Sometimes they do badges. Other times they tweak the number of apps that they feature in the top charts. Other times they kind of change the layout of search results. I don't think that Apple even knows exactly what they want from the App Store at this point because they keep changing. Maybe that's good. Maybe that's not good. I don't know.
We have a game, that's not a game, I don't know why I said that, because we're talking about games. We have an app on the App Store called Party Monster, as you know, that normally is the top search result for Party Monster, but occasionally it will get displaced by spam garbage. And today, the number one result, you know, actual Party Monster is a couple below it. The number one result is Monster High Girl Dress Up Party New College Girl Z Scary Fashion on Campus Life Free.
Makes sense, yeah. I'm sorry, guys.
It's great. I think it just depends on like if that game is newly, because it's always when it is something else, it's always something new. So I think what's happened is like it's a new free game that someone is getting like paid downloads, like, you know, paying to promote it in the lists or whatever, and so it'll go up the charts based on downloads, because some free in-app game purchase game is going to have a lower number of total downloads than our $3 quote-unquote expensive DJ app. And so then when that sort of spike goes down, then it will go back below our app in the downloads. One last thing I wanted to talk about in terms of digital distribution is the fact that it enables sales, and especially flash sales and huge sales, in a way that you never could really coordinate in the, you know, physical distribution world. You can't just send a you know, email to GameStop and Best Buy and everyone all the way around like, hey, we're doing a 95% off sale on all Halloween themed games over the next 6 hours, so everyone please go around and change the stickers and do that. But the sort of the culture of that kind of stuff that has come up around digital games is really interesting to me. And I'm not sure if I have any sort of, you know, philosophical verdict on what effect it's having on what games are being made. But I feel like there's definitely an increase in games that sell well in a like Humble Bundle, or you know, maybe as a Kickstarter or as a impulse buy, because it's only, you know, it's only $3 on Steam today, and, you know, and that kind of stuff. And like, there's a lot of examples, like Goat Simulator is one. Have you guys seen this? Goat,
yeah.
Simulator? And so Goat Simulator is not a game that would have been made before digital distribution for many reasons. One is because it's not worth $60, so you're not going to put it in the store. But it feels more so because it's like almost perfectly made for the era of people make fun of it on YouTube, and then you see a funny thing on YouTube or on Twitch or whatever, and then when it's in a Steam sale for 99 cents, then you give them 99 cents, and then like literally millions of people do that. Do you think that sort of culture has any danger? Not that I'm saying it's a dangerous thing, but do you think that has any, I guess it is a danger of reducing the number of quote unquote serious and interesting games that are getting made, or is it just like increasing the total amount of money that people are spending on games?
Yeah, see, I don't know, because I guess the problem is that I see this every time on the App Store and especially on PSN. I see a lot of coordinated sales and organized promotions by Apple and by Sony. And whether they're like the traditional sales such as Black Friday sales or Christmas sales, or whether it's a more specific topic such as Halloween games or games for the summer and stuff like that. I tend to believe that maybe they kind of create an expectation in the consumer that I'm not buying that game right now because eventually it'll be on sale. But the fact is that developers keep doing these sales, so there must be some good incentive, some sort of profit coming back from these sales, because otherwise, I mean, you're free to say, no, I don't want to participate in this sale. And I know that this is the case both for Apple promotions and for Sony promotions. You're free to say, no, I don't want to be included. So I guess the benefit of being promoted by Apple or by Sony and I guess by Microsoft and on Steam and by Nintendo, the benefit of being promoted to, you know, to be included in the social media campaigns that these big companies do outweighs the potential negatives of saying if we go on sale, then people won't buy the game when it's on at full price because they expect the game to always be on sale at some point. I too struggle to understand how exactly promotions and sales can affect the gaming market going forward. But developers keep doing them. That's the point that I keep coming back to. Developers do them, so there must be something good that we don't know because we don't have we don't have access to the sales figures. So yeah,
some people have talked about the sales figures. Like if you, some of the information is less exciting of a new thing, so people don't talk about it as much anymore. But I remember reading a couple of years ago, the Binding of Isaac, which is like an indie game on Steam, you know, popular, well reviewed. That when he made it 75% off, and I don't know if that was like Steam nominated for that or he did that or whatever. But when it was 75% off, so one quarter of the cost, then sales increased by 60 times. Wow. So that's way more revenue. And so that's like obviously beneficial for the developer of that particular game to participate in that particular sale. But then it's one of those potential tragedy of the commons things, like everyone complains about the race to the bottom on the App Store, and now even selling a 99-cent app is not the cool thing to do. You know, everything pretty much needs to be free within app purchase, or just don't even bother for a lot of types of games and apps. And so that's the sort of thing that for any given developer making that decision is reasonable. But then the sort of questions are, you know, is encouraging that good for the platform vendor? And even if it is, then what consequences do we see over the long term, and what games actually end up getting made, you know, if we're not necessarily able to invest in making The Last of Us because, you know, people will only buy games when they go on sale for 99 cents, so we should instead be making Goat Simulator?
Well, the point of the developers, and particularly the publishers, who are the ones mainly making the decision in the AAA world, like, that's always kind of been the case, that there's been a regular march down market, right? That you sell the game for $60 initially, and then after a couple months, you put it on sale for like $10 or $15 less, and, you know, maybe a year in, it's gotten down to like $30, and or maybe even like $20 in the bargain bin some places, and, you know, maybe if it's a really popular game, you'll do like a reissue of like, you know, the first two games in a series that you're about to release the third game of, and you can get both of them for $30, and so there's, I mean, that's always a something that has been done in games. And it makes sense from a sales standpoint that when people have a game that they're excited about, they want to play it right away for the most part, right? No one wants to wait to play, you know, the new Call of Duty or the new Assassin's Creed or the new Grand Theft Auto until like a year later when it's half price and all the people that they know have already played it and already moved on from playing the multiplayer and stuff like that. So, you know, you can capture more of the market by A, doing that, and B, having people know that you're going to do that, right? That as long as the schedule is reasonably regular, like people know, okay, if I, you know, if I'm not someone who's willing to pay $60 for this game, I can still get it if I'm willing to wait. And maybe there's a few people who will say, well, I would pay $60 for this game, but I also don't mind waiting 6 months to pay $30 for it. But the evidence from the sales figures strongly suggests that those people are vastly outnumbered by the number of people who just will not ever pay $60 for this game and will buy it when it hits $30. And so you just have this, you know, gradual capturing of the entire market of people that'll play that game. You capture the early adopters at $60, and then you know, capture the people that are excited about the game but don't care about playing it day one at $45. And then you capture the next group at $30. And then you capture the bargain bin guys at $10 or $15. And it works. Like, it definitely gets you more sales and makes you more money to do that. Now, does that extend to digital distribution? Clearly it does to some degree, right? Like, the example you talked about the Binding of Isaac, like, those people that bought it at that lower price, like the vast majority of them were not going to buy it at $10 or whatever it started out at. And so you've captured a large, a large new market by doing that. But the contention by people that are opposed to this stuff, and I don't know if we have the evidence to prove whether or not it's true, is that the sales schedule is so much more accelerated for digital distribution games, and the price swings are so much more wild that, you know, people are way more likely to wait and try and get it cheaper because it's so likely to be so much cheaper so much sooner. And my gut feeling is that probably the, you know, like, price discrimination, clear the market argument for doing it still applies even in digital distribution, that you're better off trying to sell it to everyone who wants the game, even if it means you have to start cutting the price eventually. But, you know, it's not as clear a win in digital distribution as it is in package distribution, because the sales are bigger and they're more frequent, and people kind of know that and are acting based on that information, as opposed to knowing in the AAA market that it's going to be this steady $15 at a time march down from the top of the market over like a year.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. My intuition is also that I'm buying more games now when they go on sale. The thing that makes me hesitant about it is that on PSN, like I have the PS4 and I'm looking at a few games and I'm like, more so than I would ever used to have been, and especially because the games are $10 more this generation, I think, than they were previously. But I'm looking at new games and I'm like, yeah, I want to play Alien Isolation eventually, but $70. Whereas, like, previously I would have been like, well, I'm going to get a game, and they're all that amount, so I'm going to get one of them, you know? But I also am just
complaining. And this is one of those things that I think to some degree they were probably hemmed in on making these kind of decisions, but I think it was probably a mistake on the part of the big publishers and the game console manufacturers to not try and push the price down for digital games a little bit. People are more nervous about paying for something digital, even when it doesn't make sense. Like, you know, you look at like modern digital distribution environments and, you know, your games are probably safer on digital distribution than they are as physical discs in some sense, right?
But I can't resell them.
Yeah, you can't resell them, so you can't recover any of the money. But if you're not someone who resells games, like, you're probably better off buying digitally in almost every respect. But people, you know, people feel like they're getting less out of digital games, and so they want to pay less. And I'm pretty sure that the publishers could afford to charge them less. Like, I mean, there's got to be $20 or more out of the cost of a package game that's going to the distribution chain, right? That's going to GameStop and like shipping companies and stuff like that. And so on digital games, they get all that back, but they've either gotten addicted to having that extra money from the previous round where digital distribution was just kind of a sideshow, and so they just charge the same price because, hey, why not, and keep the extra $20 to themselves, or they're concerned that if they drop the price by $20, that GameStop's going to hate them and going to like stop stocking their consoles and stuff like that. And some combination of those two factors and other factors that I'm not thinking of off the top of my head has led them to, oh, digital games will just be the same price as package games. Whereas I think probably everyone involved, except for GameStop, who's, you know, like I said, is going to be out of business in 5 years or 10 years anyways. Everyone else benefits from games being like $10 cheaper for digital distribution, because, you know, users are more likely to buy, and probably publishers make more in the long run, because if they, you know, if they give the consumers back like half of the distributor's cuts and keep half for themselves, then more people will buy and they're still making more money off each sale than they were for physical retail. So, you know, it seems to me like that would have been a guaranteed win for them. You know, maybe they have spreadsheets claiming otherwise, and that's why they didn't do it. But I think they should have. I think everyone would have been better off if they did.
All right, well, we'll start a petition. We'll get them to bring it back down, and then we can buy all the games. All right, everybody, thanks for listening. We always want to know what you think, so you can visit our website at www.upup.fm. You can give us feedback. You can send us an email. You can rate the show on iTunes. Do all the things you want to do, as well as find the show notes, the links that we've talked about in this show. So thanks a lot, and see you next week. Okay, so Have you guys seen about Overwatch?
I still have to watch the video, actually.
It looks pretty cool. I'm not going to lie to you.
I don't normally get this excited, like, oh, yeah, okay, some game that, like, it's just really the trailer and, like, oh, yeah, okay, you know, Blizzard makes some good games. But also, Blizzard makes some games that I'm like, yeah, okay, yeah, whatever, that I don't get that excited by, especially when it's a company getting into, okay, so first of all, for anyone who has not yet seen what the deal with this is, Overwatch is Blizzard's, basically, the simplest explanation is their take on Team Fortress. So if you've seen this, are a class-based, not taking itself too seriously type first-person shooter gameplay, that's what Overwatch is. And they've been working on this. It seems like it was part of this sort of Project Titan, which was the MMO that they discontinued, that they'd been working on for many years. But this sort of first-person shooting mechanic with interesting characters and this sort of colorful world has continued through into Overwatch, which they're releasing as a beta next year, so probably realistically it will be out the year after that. So getting as excited as I am about it this early is premature, but man, I'm excited. It looks great. So you haven't seen anything about it, Federico, other than kind of what I probably already just said?
No, I only saw a couple of screenshots on the day that Blizzard announced the game, and I was just watching the video now. I was just skimming through the video. And that's not real gameplay footage, right?
Yeah, so you're probably watching the cinematic trailer, which is like a Pixar film, basically.
Yeah.
And then there's also a gameplay trailer, which shows the gameplay. Maybe I can quickly... I can't send you a link because all of the URLs on the Overwatch site. But if you go to... Like, if you just Google Overwatch and click on the Battle.net Blizzard page, then on the left there's a gameplay trailer. Gameplay. Yeah, and you can sort of see that it's a sort of shooter, colorful. It's like Team Fortress 2 in that you are always on a team. I think the teams are always six people, and some of the maps are like sort of control and capture in like one of those... I can't remember what the Team Fortress term for it is, but it's the like rolling capture where you're sort of like one team is moving forward through a map and the other team is trying to stop them, which I enjoy that. Nigel, I've reminisced on that particular gameplay type. But one of the things, there's a few things that excite me about it, like the fact that it's sort of, it has that first person shooter team dynamic, which is good for multiple reasons, like because you can play with most of your friends will be able to play along with you, and there's like short round times, and so you can, you know, it's a lot more accessible than everyone getting together and playing a like 2 hour game of Dota or something like that. And so just the fact that it's like a game that's like that, that's fun and accessible, or, you know, hopefully looks like it will be fun and accessible. But the character design I also think is very cool, as opposed to Destiny, which is the most recent first-person shooter that I played online, where there's three character classes, but they're basically identical, and you can customize what your character looks like, but then they're always wearing a mask, so you can't see it any of the time. This is the opposite, where like the characters are like wildly different from each other and like varying sort of sizes and shapes and genders and colors and all the sort of variation in between the characters is very interesting. And there's like, I'm looking at these and like, oh, I would want to play her, or I'd want to play her, as opposed to like most of the sort of more serious games. It's like, well, you can be a, you know, puncher or a, you know, shooter or a shoot puncher, and they're all just kind of like manly men in camo. It's not very exciting.
So. Yeah, I see there's also a gorilla in Overwatch.
Yes.
I'm looking at the gameplay footage. It looks really, really colorful and like, I don't know, it looks really fun so far based on the trailer that I'm watching on YouTube. I kind of want to play as the gorilla, so.
Which would be perfect. Apparently the sort of gorilla and some of the bigger guys are like sort of tanky type classes that are able to absorb damage or whatever. And then the smaller classes can kind of jump in and weave around and deal damage and stuff like that. Sort of what you would expect from a class. I'm sure they'll have some interesting twists on it, but sort of what you would expect from a class-based game. But I am more drawn to these sorts of games where it's in a serious genre, but it has sort of a lighter feel to it, in the hope that the super hardcore professional competitive people are not going to be just like assassinating me in a quarter of a second because they're off playing Counter-Strike after like 18 years of Counter-Strike still being almost identical, but they're just really good at it. And so let them play Counter-Strike and then I'll play the colorful thing with badass gorillas and stuff.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I didn't play Titanfall when it came out on Xbox this year, because of all the, you know, the pressure of all these people that are really they really know how to play this kind of first-person shooter, and I never played these kinds of games, and I don't know all these strategies and all these little tricks that these people do. And so Titanfall is still I bought the game. I promised myself I would play the game. I never played the game because my friends told me it gets really competitive, and yeah, I should have.
I could see Overwatch going that way too, though. Like, it seems like something that's pretty squarely targeted at that, you know, more competitive market, because it's online, at least online, you know, competitive focus, if not online only. You know, there may very well not be really a single player game for something like this. And they haven't announced platforms yet, and given that it's Blizzard and that it's a first-person shooter, like, it could be PC only, which is also going to make the, you know, it trend a little more hardcore in terms of who's playing it, so...
I wouldn't be surprised if this ends up being on the consoles, because Blizzard did Diablo 3 for PlayStation. I don't know if they did for...
Yeah, but like a year and a half after... the original launch, right?
Yeah, I don't know if they would launch on consoles for sure. But then they have also done Hearthstone for iPad, like within a few months of it coming out, which was interesting. And Blizzard already does PC and Mac, and so I believe they're fairly bought into OpenGL, which I'm not sure how problematic that is on Xbox One. But I feel like there's a decent chance that they may bring this to consoles in a non- crazy amount of time. Now, whether or not you can play cross-platform between console and Mac, I don't know, because that's what I would probably end up wanting to do, is probably playing with friends who are on one or the other, and me, you know, being able to matchmake with them. And, you know, Blizzard would want to use Battle.net, which I don't know what Sony would think of that. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly how all that stuff works. Have you guys just, they're in the middle of coming out today, and so the show will go live in a few days, so it'll be, you know, it won't be breaking news by the time people are listening, but Assassin's Creed Unity apparently is full of glitches and like the frame rates are terrible and all the things you would not really expect on the fact that it's the first sort of next generation, or maybe you would expect.
Yeah, that's, I'm not too Assassin's surprised Creed. Actually that some of that stuff's twitchy. Like, it's, they've got to have been they got to be running pretty close to the edge on getting that done, given the scale of the game. It's not something like the, you know, like the last couple where they took the big leap with Assassin's Creed 3, and which was definitely twitchier than Black Flag. And like, now they've got Rogue coming out on that same, you know, on that same code base. And I assume that Unity is something brand new, like that it's, you know, I mean, obviously they evolve the technology, but that sometime like 2 or 3 years ago, someone basically, like, you know, all right, copy the entire current Assassin's Creed source tree over this other location and start just tearing it apart. And that's what they've been doing for the past 2 or 3 years, is you know, doing that as opposed to iterating the way they have with the with the previous gen ones. So yeah, I'm not surprised that it's, I'm sure they'll patch it before too long and get the worst of the problems worked out.
I always get a bad feeling when a AAA company forces game reviewers to publish their reviews on launch day of a game, because yes, it generally means that the game has problems. And I was reading an article on Polygon today about how Ubisoft did the review embargoes for Unity, and basically forcing bloggers to publish their reviews 12 hours after the availability of the game, which is crazy. And it seems that, you know, the suspicions are usually true when a review drops on the same day. It's because the publisher wants to hide as many problems as possible.
Yeah, and that's something that I'm not a must play on day one person. So the fact that there's no review before the game is actually launched doesn't bother me, because I often, if I will see a review, I'll be like, oh yeah, maybe I will buy that tomorrow. And then It's like, oh, you have to pre-order it, and then it's not even actually available, so that slightly annoys me. But the, like you say, it tends to be like 9 times out of 10 that if they don't allow reviews of the game to come out before the game actually is released, then it's probably a bad sign. Like the last big game that did that was Destiny, which obviously had a lot of problems. And actually, similarly to Destiny, Assassin's Creed Unity got 6.5 on Polygon, which is something that someone might see and be like, oh, maybe I will not buy it right away. And so they're trying to...
Yeah, Assassin's Creed Unity is hovering at 81% on Metacritic right now, which is... That's in the green, but it's very close to the edge of the green.
Yeah, and it's also, like, much worse than sort of what you would come to expect from previous Assassin's Creed. Like, Black Flag, I think, was, like, 90%. So that's something I feel almost like the game sites would do well to just release a, like, around when you would normally release a review that was not embargoed, say, hey, Assassin's Creed 4 is under embargo, and the studio has declined to allow us to tell you how good it is until it's too late. So be aware. Like, it should just be some sort of automatic sort of policy, as opposed to, like, sometimes you see them kind of complain about it on Twitter or something, but it should be kind of like in place of their review. Like, you know, we give this an intermediate review of 5, having not been allowed to tell you anything.
Black Flag is only 84 on Metacritic, which actually kind of surprises me. Because it seemed like a better entry in the series than that. But maybe Assassin's Creed definitely has collected some haters over the years, so it could be that there's some, like, one or two high-profile, very bad reviews pulling it down or something like that. But
well, if my job required me to play every single Assassin's Creed game and variation, I would probably just be sick of the whole thing by now. But I play, like, once in a while, so... I enjoy it. Have you been playing anything recently, Federica, amidst all of your moving and other business?
Yeah, I'm totally addicted to Fantasy Life on the 3DS, which is this action RPG from Level 5. It's a sort of a combination of some aspects of Animal Crossing, like you can. Customize your character, you can customize your own house, you can upgrade your house to a bigger, better place, you can buy furniture, you can buy accessories, but there's also a strong RPG component in that you can choose from one of 12 classes. They're called, each class is called a life in the game, so you can be a paladin, you can be a mercenary, you can be a cook, you can be an alchemist, you can craft items, and I'm addicted to this game because it's cute, it's got really nice graphics, it's got great music by composed by Nobuo Uematsu, and it's totally made for a portable console. You can have all these little quests and subquests. You can talk to people in the various towns. You can accept all these little fetch quests from people, and then you can also go on with the story, which is not too, you know, it's a rather simplistic story, but it's still enjoyable. And there's a lot of freedom to the game. You can go around these big environments. You can get to level 200 in the game. You can invite people over multiplayer to help you in the game, and the action RPG mechanics are really really lightweight but also fun and accessible on 3DS. So I've been playing, like, I think 15 hours in just 3 days, which is usually a sign that I'm really enjoying a game. And I've also been I've also played and finished actually Space Age on iOS, which is a new game by Big Bucket Games, that the guys that made The Incident. And it's a really, really nice kind of adventure/exploration game that's set on an alien planet. And I really love the style of Big Bucket's games, like the pixel art style. And I love the music of Space Age. And the story was really great. I kind of wish there was more of it, because I wanted to keep playing. Hopefully we'll get some sort of sequel or expansion packs eventually. I really enjoyed playing on my iPad. And I'm also starting, you mentioned this on the show actually, The Binding of Isaac. There's a new, I guess the remake version is called Rebirth. And I got it for free thanks to PlayStation Plus on my PS Vita. So I'm starting the game. I started the game last night and I'm playing now.
Yeah, we had Nevin Mergen, the designer on Space Age, on the show a few months back, and we got to play a pre-release version of the game that had the first, I don't know, 10 levels or so. So excited to actually get the final version and play through it and enjoy all the awesome music that Cable Sasser has been composing for it. I believe that was like the final hurdle to shipping the game, was that they had all this game there and it was in pretty good shape, but that it was missing the final bits of music. And although Cable is a really awesome composer, he is a full-time runner of Panic, and so his main job is not making music for video games, at least not right now. So
he really should consider that as a career, because he makes really awesome music.
Oh yeah, it's awesome. I was actually looking at, he posted a little bit about what his setup was, and it was interesting to see that it's just like a $99 plain MIDI keyboard that it isn't even one of those fancy ones with like the weighted keys or anything. It's just he would play the game, and then he would sort of see what was happening, and then he would just kind of play off the top of his head of what he felt, how he felt, and then he would go back and then he would play fills, and then he would add in a third layer or a fourth layer, and then he would start editing it. But he was just kind of like improvising on top of the cutscenes, which is a very cool thing that is more like what you would do in film scoring, as opposed to a lot of game music ends up just being a loop. So very cool to see that. Awesome. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show, Federico.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, that was awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. How can people find more about you and what you're up to?
Well, they can follow me on Twitter. I'm Vitici, V-I-T-I-C-C-I. They can go to my website, which is maxstories.net. And they can also find me on two podcasts. One is called Connected and one is called Virtual. And they're both hosted at relay.fm.